This is Audible.
Audible presents this Brilliance audio production of
Peter and the Starcatchers, written by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson, read by Jim Dale. To Story, Rob and Sophie, Marcel and Michelle, and of course Paige, whose idea this was. Chapter 1, The Neverland. The tired old carriage, pulled by two tired old horses, rumbled onto the wharf, its creaky wheels bumpety-bumping on the uneven planks, waking Peter from his restless slumber. The carriage interior, hot and stuffy, smelled of five smallish boys and one largish man, none of whom was keen on bathing. Peter was the leader of the boys because he was the oldest. Or maybe he wasn't. Peter had no idea how old he really was, so he gave himself whatever age suited him, and it suited him to always be 1 year older than the oldest of his mates. If Peter was 9 and a new boy came to St. Norbert's Home for Wayward Boys who said he was 10, why then Peter would declare himself to be 11. Also, he could spit the farthest. That made him the undisputed leader. As leader, he made it his business to keep an eye on things in general, and he was not happy with the way things were shaping up today. The boys had been told only that they were going away on a ship. As much as Peter didn't like where he'd been living for the past 7 years, the longer this carriage ride lasted, the scarier "away" sounded in his mind. They'd set out from St. Norbert's in the dark, but now Peter could see greyish daylight through the small round coach window on his side. He looked out, squinting, and saw a large shape looming by the wharf. It looked to Peter like a monster, with tall spines coming out of its back. Peter did not like the idea of walking into the belly of that monster. "Is that it?" he asked. "The ship we're going on?" He ducked then, avoiding the ham-like right fist of Edward Gremkin. He was always keenly aware of where this fist was. He'd been dodging it for 7 years now. Gremkin, second in command at St. Norbert's Home for Wayward Boys, was a man of numerous rules, many of them invented right on the spot, all of them enforced by means of a swift cuff to the ear. He paid little attention to whose ear his fist actually landed on. All the boys were rule breakers, as far as Gremkin was concerned. This time the fist clipped an ear belonging to a boy named Thomas, who had been slumped half asleep in the carriage next to the ducking Peter.
"Oh!" said Thomas. "Do not end a sentence with a preposition," said Mr. Gremkin.
He was also the grammar teacher at St. Norbert's.
"But I didn't. Ooh!"
said Thomas, upon being cuffed a second time by Gremkin, who had a strict rule against back-talk. For a moment, the carriage was silent, except for the bumpity-bump. Then Peter tried again.
"Sir," he said, "is that our ship?"
He kept an eye on the fist, in case "ship" turned out to be a preposition. Peter was thinking about trying to run away, but he didn't know if that was possible. To run away from away. In any event, he didn't see much opportunity for escape. There were sailors and dockhands everywhere, carts and carriages. Near the front, fancily dressed people boarded the ship via a set of stairs with a rope handrail. Toward the front, some pigs and a cow were being led up a steep plank, followed by commoners dressed more like Peter and his friends. Gremkin glanced out the round window and grinned, but not in a pleasant way. There wasn't a pleasant bone in his body.
"Yes, that's your ship," he said. "The Neverland."
"What's Neverland?" said a boy named Prentice, who was fairly new to the orphanage, and thus did not see the fist until it hit his ear.
"Oh!"
he said.
"Don't you be asking stupid questions,"
said Gremkin, who defined stupid questions as questions he could not answer.
"All you need to know is this ship will be your home for the next 5 weeks."
"5 weeks, sir?" asked Peter.
"If you're lucky," said Gremkin,
leaning out of the carriage now to study the sky.
"If a storm doesn't blow you halfway to hell,"
he smiled again,
"or worse."
"Worse than hell, sir?"
inquired James, the second youngest boy.
"He means if the ship sinks,"
said Tubby Ted, who had a gift for looking on the dark side.
"And we wind up in the sea, swimming for our lives."
"But I can't swim,"
said James.
"None of us can swim."
"I can swim,"
Tubby Ted declared proudly. "You can float," corrected Peter. Even Gremkin cracked a smile at that, yellow tooth stumps showing through chapped lips. Peter looked down the wharf and saw a much nicer-looking and bigger ship painted a shiny black. Its crew wore uniforms, unlike that of the Neverland. It too was being loaded and seemed ready to set sail. If it came down to choosing between the two ships...
"It don't matter," said Gremkin brightly, his mood improving. "Swim, sink, or float. The sharks will take care of all you boys before you get a chance to drown."
"Sharks,"
said James.
"Big fish with lots of teeth,"
said Tubby Ted.
"They eat people."
"What if there's no people in the sea?"
said Thomas.
"What do the sharks eat then?"
"Whales,"
said Tubby Ted.
"But they like people better, and there's plenty of people in the sea. Ships is always going down. I heard about one."
"Oh! That's enough of your jabber,"
said Gremkin, who had a rule against too much jabber. The carriage pulled to a stop beside the ship's aft gangplank. As Gremkin and the boys climbed out, a thick, bald man in a grimy officer's uniform thumped down the gangplank and approached the carriage.
"You Gremkin?"
he said.
"I am,"
said Gremkin.
"And you are?"
"Slank. William Slank, first officer, second in command of the Neverland."
The man made a face as if he'd just bitten into a rancid prune. It occurred to Peter that Slank didn't like being second in anything.
"These are the orphans, then?"
"They are,"
said Gremkin.
"And you're welcome to them."
"I don't care for boys," observed Slank.
"Then you'll definitely not care for these,"
said Gremkin.
"We've had boys on board before,"
said Slank.
"They was always stirring up the rats."
The boys glanced at each other.
"Rats?" "The thing to do,"
said Gremkin,
"is keep them disciplined."
To illustrate, he shot his fist sideways, not looking where it was going. It struck Prentice, who, being fairly new, had not yet learned that it was unwise to stand immediately to Gremkin's right.
"Oh!"
said Prentice.
"Sir,"
said James to Slank,
"there's rats on the ship."
"Don't you be playing with the rats,"
said Slank, cuffing James on the ear.
"They make a tasty treat when the food runs out."
"The food runs out?"
asked Tubby Ted, suddenly reluctant to take another step.
"When?"
Slank slapped him across the ear and said,
"After we eat you."
Gremkin nodded approvingly, confident now that he was leaving the boys in good hands. Peter scanned the area for a place to run and hide. He saw a supply store offering pulleys and hemp rope, some taverns, the Salty Dog, the Mermaid's Song. Mermaids? Peter wondered. But everywhere he looked, there were sailors and dock workers, rough men with rough hands. He wouldn't get 10 paces before one of them would collar him, if Slank didn't collar him first.
"I'll be getting back to St. Norbert's,"
Gremkin said. He turned toward the coach, paused for a moment, then turned back and said,
"You boys better watch out for yourselves."
In 7 years, that was the nicest thing Peter had ever heard Gremkin say.
"All right,"
said Slank, as Gremkin turned back to the coach.
"You boys get on board. We're waiting for one more piece of cargo, and then we cast off."
Peter eyed the nicer ship down the wharf. Some soldiers were approaching it, carrying rifles with bayonets. The soldiers wore crisp blue uniforms and black shiny boots. They walked on either side of a horse-drawn cart that carried a single trunk, black, done all around with chains and padlocks. The boys hesitated, taking their first good look at the Neverland. It wasn't as big as they'd expected, and it looked old and poorly kept. Frayed ropes, peeling paint, barnacles and green slime climbing the hull from the waterline.
"Get a move on,"
said Slank.
"I can't swim,"
whispered James.
"We'll be all right," said Peter. "It can't be worse than St. Norbert's."
"Yes, it can,"
said Tubby Ted.
"The food runs out."
"Sharks,"
Thomas reminded them.
"Rats."
"We'll be all right,"
repeated Peter, and he started up the gangplank, being the leader, but still thinking about finding a way to escape before the ship set sail. Chapter 2. The Second Trunk. Not far down the wharf from the Salty Dog and the Mermaid's Song, two men toiled in a dark, dismal warehouse, its enormous doors open to the harbour and the ships that were preparing for departure.
"Are we done, then?"
asked Alf, the bigger of the two. He had a nosewort the size and shape of a small mushroom,
because I could use some grog.
Alf, being a sailor, could always use some grog.
"Not yet," said Mac. "Slank says we got one more to get aboard, this one over here."
Mac, a thin man but as strong as any hand on the Neverland, had a tattoo of a snake's head on his neck, the snake's body disappearing into his sour clothes. Mac pointed to a corner of the warehouse where a filthy canvas was draped over a bulky object. The two men trudged over. Mac grabbed a corner of the canvas and pulled it off, revealing a common-looking trunk made of rough wood, but held shut by thick chain and secured by two, no, three, padlocks. Alf studied the trunk, frowning.
"Ain't this the trunk them soldiers brought in here this morning?" he asked.
"It looks like it," said Mac,
"but it ain't. There was two trunks coming together. The black one got loaded onto the Wasp by them soldiers. Heavy as lead it was. Then Slank pulls me aside and says he wants us real careful-like to put this one aboard the Neverland. He says tie the canvas tight round it and walk it up the main gangway like it belonged to one of the travellers. He says if we do this right, there's two bob more in our pay."
"A piece?" said Alf.
"A piece," said Mac.
"All right, then,"
said Alf, who was not one to ask questions when two bob was involved.
"Let's tie her up, then," said Mac. "You lift the end there, and I'll tuck this canvas underneath and slip the rope round it."
"Why don't you lift the end?" said Alf.
"It's me back, Alf," complained Mac. "You know how it troubles me."
"No more than mine troubles me," said Alf.
"But I said it first,"
said Mac. Alf sighed. The longer they argued, and Alf knew from experience that Mac would argue this point a good long time, the less chance he'd have at some grog before they set sail.
"All right, then,"
Alf said, and he squatted to grab hold of the end of the trunk. Alf was a simple man of simple wants. What he hoped to get from life was food that was soft enough to chew, a place to sleep out of the rain, and some grog now and again. Alf had never known true happiness, and he didn't expect to. And so he was not ready at all for what happened when his rough, calloused hands touched the trunk. First, he felt it, a warmth starting in his hands but quickly moving up his arms and down his back and into his legs, and everywhere the warmth went, it was wonderful, like stepping into a bath. In an instant, the pain in his bent old spine, the throbbing pain that he'd lived with since almost his first day on the docks, was gone. So was the aching weariness in his legs. Gone. But there was more. There was a smell. It was flowers. New grass in a meadow right after a spring rain. A fresh orange being peeled. It was cinnamon and honey and bread just baked and pulled from the oven. And another smell even more wonderful than all the others, though Alf couldn't place it, like nighttime, he thought. Alf could see light now, swirling around his head, colours and sparkles, moving to music, dancing to the sound of bells. Yes, it was bells, tiny ones by the sound of them, and it was a sweet and joyful sound, though Alf could hear something else in it, something that seemed to be trying to tell Alf something. He strained to hear it. He wanted to hear it.
"Alf,"
said Mac, shaking Alf's shoulder harder now, hard enough so that Alf let go of the trunk. And when he did, the wonderful smells were gone, and so were the lights and the bells. And Alf could feel the weight come back into his body, his back and his arms and his legs, along with all the old aches and pains. And he felt himself settling, as though he'd been, but that was impossible, floating above the warehouse floor, just a little bit of an inch, but floating. He brushed off his hands, thinking someone had put rat poison on the outside of the trunk. He'd seen sailors go into crazy dance from messing with rat poison.
"Alf," said Mac again, "what's wrong with you?"
Alf looked at Mac, then down at the trunk, then back at Mac. He put his fingers in both ears, looking silly.
"I when I touched it,
Alf said.
Didn't you hear them?
Hear what?
Said Mac.
The bells,
said Alf.
What bells?
Said Mac.
There weren't no bells.
Bells, said Alf.
And lights, and...
He stopped, seeing the way Mac was looking at him.
Rat poison,
he said, now slapping his hands against his pants, trying to get them clean.
You already been to the tavern today?
Asked Mac suspiciously.
Rat poison,
said Alf, now rubbing his hands on a dirty old towel. Mac was looking at him all funny.
Got to get it off me hands.
Bells?
Mac teased him, shaking his head. He turned back to the trunk. Alf saw that Mac had slipped the canvas more tightly around the trunk and the rope around the canvas. A tiny bit of the trunk still showed.
Mac,
said Alf,
I dares you to touch it.
What?
Said Mac.
Me?
Just touch the trunk,
said Alf.
On the wood, there.
I'm not messing with no rat poison. You remember what happened to Hungry Bob?
Mac considered himself a cautious man, and the truth was, he was afraid to touch the trunk now. He knew that something had happened when Alf touched it. Somehow, he'd felt it. No, Mac decided there was something strange about this trunk. Why else would Slank be giving special orders and offering to Bob? Mac was not going to touch it, thank you very much.
It's not our job to fool with it,
Mac said, pulling the rope tight. The canvas now covered the trunk entirely.
Slank said put it aboard the Neverland, and that's that.
But, Mac,
said Alf,
I'm telling you, God's truth, rat poison or not, it felt good.
Let's just finish the job,
said Mac, pulling the knot tight,
and take our two bob to the tavern, get our grog quick-like, and forget about this trunk.
All right, then,
said Alf, though he didn't think he would soon forget that feeling he'd just had. Maybe once the Neverland was underway, he could sneak in and visit this trunk again. Grunting, the two men lifted the canvas-wrapped trunk onto a handcart and trundled it out of the warehouse onto the wharf. A minute later, they passed the Wasp, whose crew were preparing to cast off.
She's a pretty ship, ain't she?
Said Mac.
What?
Said Alf, who'd been thinking about the trunk.
I say, the Wasp is a beauty,
said Mac.
I'd love to sail on her some day. They say she's the only ship afloat that might outrun the Sea Devil.
The mention of the pirate ship won Alf's full attention. The Sea Devil was the ship of the most feared pirate on the seven seas. Sailors said that if you caught sight of the Sea Devil, it was time to make your peace with your Maker, because you'd be with him within the hour.
No ship can outrun the Sea Devil,
said Alf.
Nobody ever has.
Till now,
said Mac.
The Wasp was built for just that, and Captain Scott is as able a seaman as ever sailed these waters, unlike the idiot in charge of our bilge bucket.
Sneering, Max nodded toward the Neverland, now just ahead.
Aye,
said Alf.
Pembridge could capsize a dinghy on dry land.
Cyrus Pembridge, the Neverland's captain, was widely regarded as the most incompetent man to command a ship since the formation of water.
Who in the name of common sense would put to sea on that ship with that man in charge?
Wondered Mac.
Well,
Alf answered,
we are.
You?
Mac said.
But nobody else would hire the likes of us.
They were alongside the Neverland now. The ship had been loaded and provisioned. The crew was preparing to cast off. Most of the passengers were on deck. Some were looking around anxiously at the decrepit ship and the scruffy crew in whose hands they were placing their lives. Others were leaning on the dockside rail watching the cast-off preparations. Among these, Alf noticed, was a group of five boys near the stern. They looked plainly scared, except for one, a wiry boy with bright orange hair, not the largest of the lot, but the one who seemed to be in charge. He had an air about him, Alf thought, the look of a boy who doesn't miss much.
"It's about time,"
said Slank, chomping down the gangplank trailed by two more seamen.
"You're late. Tide's begun to run."
To the men behind him, he said,
"Get this cargo trunk aboard!"
As the men bent to heft the load, Alf, not thinking, not knowing why he did it, slipped his hand under the canvas flap, thrusting it forward until his fingers felt the smooth wood.
"Here, now,"
said Slank.
"What the dickens are you doing?"
Alf,
said Mac,
What are you doing?
But Alf didn't hear them. Instantly he was lost in it all again. The warmth and the smells, the music and the floating. And it was so good. Especially the sweet song. There was something else in there, too. Something the bells were saying, trying to tell him. What was it?
Hands off that cargo,
Slank yelled. Alf felt himself yanked away from the trunk. And then the music was gone, and all the other good feelings with it. Alf was wobbly, but with Mac's help he managed to keep his feet. Alf watched two men carry the trunk onto the ship, and he felt a sadness come over him because he knew he might not hear the music again. He almost wept, except that a man like Alf didn't cry. Then, he didn't know why, Alf looked toward the stern and found himself looking right into the startlingly blue eyes of the orange-haired boy.
"Come on, Alf," said Mac, gently tugging at Alf's coat, concerned about his old friend's strange behavior.
But for a moment Alf held still, his gaze still locked with that of the orange-haired boy.
"Come on," repeated Mac. "We're casting off."
Alf turned and followed his friend toward the lines that held the ship to the wharf. After a few steps he looked back, but the boy was gone. "Boys can get into all sorts of trouble," he thought, his ears still ringing from the music of those bells. Chapter 3. Molly. Peter trotted aft on the Neverland's bustling deck, dodging the sailors making final preparations for casting off and getting underway. The forward gangplank had been detached, hauled aboard, and stowed. Now sailors were working on the aft gangway. When they were done, there would be no way off the ship. Peter's plan was to dart down the gangway just before they finished the job and disappear into the bustle on the wharf. He figured the ship's departure wouldn't be held up just for him, a mere one boy out of five. He had no plan for what he'd do once he got off the ship. All he knew was he didn't want to stay on it. He'd seen enough of the Neverland to decide that it was an unpleasant, dirty place run by unpleasant, dirty men. They were around him now, stinking of sweat, struggling with lines and sails as an officer shouted orders that consisted mostly of curses. "They don't seem like a happy group," thought Peter. He neared the aft gangway and stopped, looking for his chance to flee. Directly ahead, blocking his path, stood the first officer, Slank, supervising the gangway crew. Just beyond, two sailors were carrying the canvas-draped cargo that had been brought onto the ship at the last minute. Peter had watched the cargo's arrival and the little drama that had played out on the wharf. He'd seen the sailor, the one with the big nosewort, reach under the canvas and touch something. He'd seen the look that had come over the man's face. "He looks so happy," Peter thought. "Why did he look so happy?" Peter studied the mysterious cargo now being maneuvered into the aft hold. It didn't look heavy. The sailors handled it fairly easily. Peter wondered what was inside. He was distracted by a giggle and turned to see a rare sight, a girl. He'd not seen many girls over the past few years. St. Norbert's had only one, the headmaster's daughter, an unpleasant, sallow-faced child who amused herself by dropping spiders onto the heads of boys passing beneath her third-floor window. This girl he saw now in no way resembled the headmaster's daughter. She had large, wide-set green eyes and long brown hair that curled slightly and turned to gold at the tips. She wore a long, straight blue dress that accentuated the slimness of her frame. She was perhaps an inch taller than Peter, and by the look of her, she took baths. At St. Norbert's, Peter took one bath a month, unless he could get out of it. He straightened his posture and tried to look older. The girl stood next to a stout woman wearing a wide-ranging and complicated skirt and wielding a formidable black umbrella. The woman's hair was an unnatural shade of red, and she wore a great deal of powder on her face, caked and cracked at the edges of her mouth and nose. She was surveying the ship and crew, and it was clear she did not approve of either. The canvas-wrapped cargo was lowered into the hold and disappeared. The brown-haired girl watched it go, then glanced around quickly. Her eyes fell on Peter. He half expected her to look away, as strangers do when their gazes lock by accident, but she didn't. She kept her eyes on him, studying him openly, until finally it was he who broke the contact. Peter turned toward the wharf.
"Ready, sir!"
shouted a seaman.
"Get aboard, then!" shouted Slang. "We're wasting time!"
Peter's attention returned to the gangway, which he saw was about to be hauled aboard. This was it, his chance to escape. He tensed his legs as he prepared for the dash to the wharf.
Ready, set, Peter!
He felt a hand grab his shirt from behind.
Peter!
It was James.
Not now, whispered Peter. Go away! But I lost you, and I couldn't find you, and...
Go away, hissed Peter, pushing James from him. He looked around quickly and saw the girl staring at him. He looked back to where several sailors were preparing to haul up the gangway. Again Peter stiffened, ready to run for it.
Please,
James pleaded, weeping, his voice desperate.
I'm scared.
Peter looked, he didn't know why, back up at the girl. She was watching him intently. For an instant he thought her expression meant that she disapproved of his shoving James, and it bothered him. Why do I care what she thinks? But then the girl shook her head side to side, barely moving it. It's not disapproval, Peter thought. She's warning me. The girl nodded her head toward the bow of the ship. Peter looked that way and saw a huge man, more a horse than a man, who hadn't been there a minute before. His enormous black-booted feet were braced on the deck. His right hand held a long, coiled whip. I wonder what he... It happened in a second. At most, two. A sailor bolted for the gangplank, his bare feet slapping wood. He had taken perhaps three long strides when the whip cracked. It moved much too fast for Peter to see it, and wrapped itself around this man's ankle like a snake. The sailor crashed to the deck as the giant jerked the whip back, dragging the man effortlessly, as if he were no more than a dead cat, back to the feet of the scowling Slank. Slank spat on the sailor.
"Having second thoughts, were you now?" he said. "Somebody always does come cast-off time. That's why we have little Richard here."
Slank nodded back at the huge man, then drew back his leg and kicked the would-be escapee hard in the ribs. The man moaned and squirmed on the deck.
"You'll be starting out this voyage with a week in the brig," said Slank. "Hard tack and water for a week. You can sleep with the rats for a while, and if that don't improve your attitude, we'll give you another taste of little Richard's lash. Only this time he won't be so gentle."
Slank glared around the deck.
"Anybody else having thoughts of leaving?"
he said. The sailors, avoiding Slank's stare, busied themselves with their work.
"I thought not," said Slank. "Now get this bag of lice out of my sight."
As the sailor was lifted, still moaning and hauled below, Slank resumed his supervision of the gangway crew.
"Ready!" he shouted. "Heave to!"
The sailors grunted, and the gangway was raised up off the wharf and slid back onto the deck. Slank gave the order to cast off the lines, aft first, so the bow, pushed by the tide, began to slowly swing away from the wharf. No getting off the ship now. Peter glanced up again at the girl. She was still watching him. If not for her warning, it would have been his ankle snared by the whip, and his bruised body being hauled off to the brig. He nodded to the girl, just a bit. It was the closest he could come to thanking her. The girl nodded back, her face serious, but her eyes betraying a hint of amusement. And then, to Peter's surprise, she walked over to the short set of ladder-like stairs that led from the aft-deck cabins to the main deck, collected her skirts into a fistful of fabric, and descended. The stout woman leaned over the rail and called after her,
"Miss Molly! Miss Molly!"
But the girl paid no mind. She walked up to Peter, who made himself as tall as he could. They were just eye to eye.
"Thinking of leaving us, were you?" she asked.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Peter said.
"Don't you?"
she said, smiling now.
"No, I don't." "Good," she said, "because it would be a shame to miss a voyage aboard such a lovely ship as the Neverland."
The stout woman leaning over the upper rail snorted, making a noise like an irate duck.
"Lovely ship indeed," she said. "It's a floating sink-house, is what it is, pardon my French, and barely floating at that."
"That's Mrs. Bumbrake," said the girl, still looking straight at Peter. "She's my governess."
"Your father buys us passage on a garbage scow," said Mrs. Bumbrake. "But does he sail with us?" "Oh, no, not him. He sails on the Wasp, the finest ship in all of England."
"I'm sure father has his reasons," said the girl. Mrs. Bumbrake made the duck sound again.
"My name is Molly Astor," the girl said to Peter.
"What's your name?"
Peter, he said. What's your last name?
I don't know, he said. It was true. Back at St. Norbert's, he'd once asked Mr. Gremkin what his last name was, and Gremkin had boxed his ear and told him it was a stupid question. Peter never asked again.
Well, Mr. Peter Nobody, said Molly, do you know how old you are?
How old are you? Said Peter.
I'm 12, said Molly.
I'm 13, said Peter.
Oh, wait, said Molly, I just remembered. Today is my birthday. I'm 14.
Peter frowned. Wait, he said, if you were 12 and today's your birthday, you'd be 13.
Not in my family, said Molly. In my family, we only celebrate even-numbered birthdays.
Peter was impressed. He'd never thought of that.
I just remembered something myself, he said. Today is also my birthday, and I am now,
he paused dramatically, 16.
No, said Molly, too much. I'll accept 14. We'll both be 14.
Peter thought about it.
All right, then, he said, 14. So, Mr. 14-year-old Peter Nobody, said Molly, why are you going to Rundoon?
What's Rundoon? Asked Peter. Molly laughed.
You really don't know, she said.
No, said Peter.
Well, said Molly, you'll know soon enough because that's where this ship is sailing. My father is to be the new ambassador there in the court of His Royal Highness King Zaboff.
She held up the three middle fingers of her right hand.
The third.
The daughter of an ambassador, said Mrs. Bunbrake. And he puts us on this sea-going dirt bucket. Pardon my French.
What kind of a place is Rundoon? Asked Peter. Mrs. Bunbrake made the duck sound.
Not a terribly pleasant one, I'm afraid, said Molly. The people are nice enough, but the king is not nice at all.
The king? Said Peter.
His Royal Highness King Zaboff the Third, said Molly, and again she held up three fingers. He's a bad man.
What do you mean he's bad? Said Peter. And why do you hold up your fingers when you say his name?
I'm practicing, said Molly. If you don't salute with these three fingers when you say his name and he finds out, he has these very fingers cut off.
He does? Said Peter.
He does, said Molly. There's a shop in Rundoon that sells nothing but two-fingered gloves. Does a brisk business, too.
Oh, said Peter.
But that's not the worst part, said Molly.
It's not?
No, the king's late father, His Royal Highness King Zaboff the Second, was eaten by a snake.
So? Said Peter.
It wasn't just any snake, said Molly. It was the pet snake of His Royal Highness King Zaboff the Third.
Both Molly and Peter held up three fingers this time.
His snake ate his father? Peter said. Yes, said Molly. Somehow,
she arched her eyebrows knowingly,
the snake got loose in the father's bedroom while he was sleeping. They say the son wasn't a bit upset, didn't even seem surprised when it ate his father. And now as king, he keeps the snake by his throne and feeds it by hand.
What does he feed the snake?
Asked little James, speaking up for the first time.
And who's this young gentleman? Asked Molly.
He's James, said Peter, and don't ask him his last name because he doesn't know it either.
What does he feed the snake?
Repeated James.
I mean, now that his father is gone.
Pigs, mostly, said Molly. But father says that sometimes, if one of his servants has disappointed him, the king...
Molly!
Interrupted Mrs. Bunbury.
That's enough.
James was crying again.
Peter,
he sniffled,
I don't want to go where there's a mean king and hungry snakes.
Here now, boomed an angry voice behind Peter. Recognizing the tone, Peter was already ducking before the now ended, and thus he received only a glancing blow from First Officer Slank.
You runts ain't supposed to be here,
shouted Slank at Peter and James.
This here is for first-class passengers. These here ladies...
He glanced up toward Mrs. Bunbrake, whose skirts swirled in the wind, revealing a plump ankle, a pink flash of shin. Slank's mouth went slack for a moment, then he smacked his lips. Mrs. Bunbrake blushed and tilted her head down, raising her eyes so she could bat them at the smitten Slank.
These here lovely ladies...
he said, turning back to Peter and James.
Do not want to be bothered by riffraff like you.
Molly said, "But they aren't bothering us."
"Off with you, right now,"
said Slank, ignoring Molly and giving Peter and James a rough shove, so that Peter had to grab James to keep him from falling.
"There's no need for that," said Molly.
"All due respect, miss," said Slank, "but I knows how to handle this here riffraff. We've had these orphan boys aboard before, and if you let 'em..."
"Orphans?" said Molly, her eyes widening. "These are the orphans?"
"Yes, miss," said Slank. "We got 5 of them this voyage."
Molly, somber now, stared at Peter.
"What?"
said Peter.
"Oh, my,"
said Mrs. Bunbury.
"What?"
repeated Peter. But Molly said nothing.
"Get moving,"
said Slank, shoving Peter and James again.
"And if you don't want to feel Little Richard's lash, you'll stay astern until we reach Rundoon. After that, your sorry hides belong to Zarboff."
Peter froze.
"King Zarboff?"
he said, slowly raising 3 fingers.
"The third?"
Slank laughed, pleased by the fear on Peter's face.
"Why, yes," he said. "You didn't know. You'll be spending your days as a servant in the court of His Royal Majesty. He goes through a lot of servants, does the king. Seems we got to bring him a new lot every trip we make. So my advice is step lively unless you want to see his snake from the inside."
Slank, roaring with laughter, gave Peter and James another shove. The 2 boys stumbled forward, James sobbing. When they reached the bow, Peter turned and saw that Molly was still watching him. The Neverland's sails were almost all hoisted now. The ship was moving out of the harbour. Peter glanced over the side at the dark water, gauging the distance to land. But he'd never tried to swim, and he knew this was not the time or the place to learn. Besides, the way James was clinging to his shirt sleeve, if he went over the side, they'd both end up drowning. No, there was no escaping it now. They were on their way to Rundoon. Chapter 4 The Sea Devil. Far from the wharf, well across the bay and almost to the open sea, was a tangle of rocks so treacherous that no captain familiar with these waters would sail his ship there. Over the years many ships had struck these rocks and sunk. They lay in pieces, scattered everywhere, masts, bows, keels. It was the perfect place to hide a ship. Angel's Graveyard, it was called, and it so frightened most sailors that they would not even look in that direction. But there was a ship in there now, amid the huge rocks, long and low, black as coal, with 3 masts pointed towards the sky like skeleton fingers. On the foredeck stood 2 men, 1 squat and 1 tall.
"Can you see her?"
said the squat man. He wore a striped shirt and blue wool pants that didn't quite reach his ankles. His blistered bare feet were dark as tar.
"Not yet,"
replied the tall man, squinting through a spyglass. He was a strikingly unpleasant figure, with a pockmarked face and a large red nose like a prize turnip glued to his face. His long black hair, greasy from years without washing, stained the shoulders of the red uniform coat he'd stolen from a navy sailor on the high seas, just before escorting that wretched soul over the side of the ship. He had dark, deep-set, piercingly black eyes, overshadowed by eyebrows so bushy that he had to brush them away to see through the glass. But his most prominent feature was the thick growth of hair on his upper lip, long and black, lovingly maintained, measuring nearly a foot between its waxed and pointed tips. It was this feature that gave him his name, the most feared name on the sea, Black Stash.
"There's a hunk of worm food in the way, the Neverland,"
he said.
"What kind of fool name is that for a ship?"
"It's a fool name, all right," said the squat sailor.
"Shut up,"
said Black Stash.
"Hi, Captain."
Black Stash moved a few steps to his right, then squinted through the glass again.
"There she is," he said, "the Wasp, clear as day. Now that there is a rival worthy of the Sea Devil. So she thinks she can sting us, does she? Outrun us?"
He laughed, and so did the squat man, and so did the 12 or so pirates within earshot, though they didn't know what they were laughing at. The crew of the Sea Devil understood. If Black Stash laughed, you laughed. If he snarled, you snarled. If he breathed in your direction, you ran for cover. Rat breath, his sailors called him behind his back. It was said he liked to eat vermin raw, with a touch of sea salt.
When Blackstache had heard enough laughter, he raised his arm, and the crew quieted immediately. He turned to the squat man who had been the Sea Devil's first mate for a year now, the longest anyone had ever gone in that position without being heaved overboard by the captain.
"We've got the ladies ready, don't we?" asked Blackstache.
"Aye, Captain, we do it that."
"Then we'll just see who's the faster ship, won't we, Smee?"
"Aye, we will, sir," said Smee, "if the ladies hold."
The ladies were Blackstache's secret weapon, a special set of sails he'd had the ship's sailmakers make, using patterns that Blackstache had obtained from, of all places, a ladies' corset maker. Though they had not yet been tested at sea, Blackstache was convinced that his invention would revolutionize the pirate industry. He was saving the ladies for just the right moment, when he was heading downwind, closing on his prey for the kill.
"They'll hold," he said.
He spat on the deck, then turned to the sailors gathered near.
"We'll see who's the fastest ship afloat, amen," he said. "And when we do, the Wasp won't be floating any more."
The sun-bronzed pirates cheered, and not just because they had to. They knew there would be treasure on board soon, with a share for them. Blackstache saw the greed in their eyes.
"Treasure, lads," he shouted. "The greatest treasure ever taken to sea."
The pirates cheered again, louder this time.
"Oh, so some have said,"
said Blackstache, and he turned to stare at a cage on the main deck. There was a man inside the cage, a uniformed sailor. He huddled in a corner, shaking at the sound of Blackstache's voice.
"And if this scurvy dog is wrong," said Blackstache,
his black eyes boring in on the terrified prisoner,
"then he'll wish he'd never been born, that I vow."
"The treasure's on the Wasp, I promise," cried the prisoner. "I heard it with my own ears."
"It had better be," Blackstache said, "or I'll wear them ears on a necklace."
Ignoring the man's whimpers, Blackstache turned and raised the glass to his eye again.
"They're hoisting sail,"
he said,
"making to catch the tide. Tell the men to make ready to follow."
Smee relayed the order, and the pirates swung smoothly into action. They didn't look pretty, but they were an efficient crew, well trained by the whip. Blackstache ignored them, his gaze still aimed through the glass.
"You're mine, Wasp,"
he mumbled on foul breath, a rare smile on his thin lips.
"You and everything you hold, mine."
Chapter 5. Captain Pembridge. The boys were shown to their quarters in the Neverland by a gaunt, hollow-eyed sailor called Hungry Bob. He led them down a ladder and along a narrow passageway below decks, stopping in front of a low opening.
"Here you go, lads," he said. "You're home away from home."
Peter, followed by the others, ducked through the opening. What they found was depressing, even measured against the low standards of St. Norbert's, a tiny, gloomy, windowless space lit only by a sputtering oil lamp. The air reeked of smoke and rotten fish. The floor was bare, except for a chipped crockery pot in the corner.
"We're all supposed to sleep here," Peter said, "but there's not enough room."
"Oh, you'll be glad you're close together,"
said Hungry Bob.
"Keep you warm."
"But it smells," said James.
"It does,"
said Hungry Bob, sniffing.
"Not so's I can tell."
Hungry Bob was not exactly a fragrant flower himself.
"Anyways, you get used to it."
He pointed to the crockery pot.
"I put your dinner in the corner there. You eat once a day, and you want to eat right quick when I brings it, or the rats get it first."
The boys, who hadn't eaten since the night before, brightened at the prospect of food. They gathered around the pot.
"Where's the plates?" said Prentice. "And the spoons?"
Hungry Bob had to grab the wall to keep from falling over with laughter.
"Plates?"
he roared.
"Spoons? Then how do we eat?"
said Prentice.
"Like the rest of us," said Hungry Bob. "With your hands."
The boys peered doubtfully into the pot, which contained a darkish liquid. It looked far from appetizing, but they were hungry. Tubby Ted, always the first to take action where food was concerned, cupped his hands and scooped out a handful of the liquid, with some small greyish lumps floating in it. He sniffed it, wrinkled his nose, then shrugged and took a lump into his mouth. Immediately he spat it onto the floor.
"It's alive!"
he screamed. The boys looked at the lump on the floor, and, sure enough, it was wriggling.
"It's a worm," said Tubby Ted. "He fed us worms."
Hungry Bob picked up the worm and looked at Tubby Ted.
"You ain't going to eat this?"
he asked. Tubby Ted shook his head violently.
"Your loss," said Hungry Bob.
Then as the boys watched, slack-jawed, he popped the worm into his mouth, chewed thoughtfully, and swallowed.
"Moth, maggot," he said. "I prefer fly, but moth is good too."
Tubby Ted turned away, retching.
"You eat worms?" said Peter.
"I eat what I can on this ship," said Hungry Bob. "Ate a piece of rope once. 2 months at sea we was. Mr. Slank had me lashed for that, but it was worth it. That was a tasty rope. Oof. You boys would be wise to eat whatever you get, because you won't get much."
"But," said Peter, "I mean worms."
"If you don't fancy worms,"
said Hungry Bob, nodding toward the communal bowl,
"you don't want to know what else cook puts in there. Let's just say worms is one of the choice items."
Thomas, peering into the pot again, gasped.
"There's something swimming in there," he said. It's a mouse."
"Really?"
said Hungry Bob, looking into the pot.
"Why, so it is. Cook must be in a generous mood. Usually he don't serve mouse except on special occasions like Christmas."
Thomas moved away from the pot.
"I'm not hungry," he said.
"Nor me,"
said James, and then Prentice. Tubby Ted was still retching.
"Sir, we can't eat this," said Peter.
"As you like," said Hungry Bob, picking up the pot. "This'll make a fine dinner for me, but in a day or two you boys will get hungry, and I'll be taking this pot out polished clean by your tongues."
"I don't think so," said Peter. "Look, sir, there must be better food on this ship."
"Oh, there is,"
agreed Hungry Bob,
"but not for me or you."
"But, sir," said Peter, "please, if you would—"
"Listen, boy,"
interrupted Hungry Bob.
"You're wasting your time talking to me. I ain't the one who decides these things. I'm a deck rat, not the captain."
"Well," said Peter, "what if I ask the captain?" That struck Hungry Bob as even funnier than the request for spoons.
"Ask the captain,"
he roared, almost choking.
"Ask the captain. Yes, you do that. You ask Captain Pembridge for a nice dinner."
Chuckling, muttering,
"Ask the captain,"
to himself, Hungry Bob ducked back through the opening, carrying the dinner pot. The younger boys looked at Peter, who was not sure he liked being the one who was supposed to know what to do. "All right, then," he said. The boys kept watching him. "All right, then," Peter repeated. "I'll be back."
"Where are you going, Peter?"
asked James.
"I'm going to see the captain," said Peter.
He wasn't sure this was a good idea, especially after Slank's warning to stay away from the aft part of the ship, but he figured he had to do something.
"You wait here,"
he said to the boys, and ducked out into the passageway. As Peter climbed the ladder, he heard a drunken voice bellowing. Reaching the deck, he looked around and saw that the voice was coming from amidships, where a red-faced and very round man, in a comically elaborate, too-small uniform, was shouting odd orders to an audience consisting of Slank and a half-dozen crewmen.
"Avast the main mizzen,"
the round man shouted.
"You heard Captain Pembridge," shouted Slank. "Avast the main mizzen."
His voice was stern, but Peter saw he was smirking.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
shouted the men, and, grinning, they began fussing busily with various lines, tying and untying knots. Peter didn't know anything about ships, but he could see immediately that they were merely pretending to do something nautical.
"Keelhaul the scuppers," shouted the captain. "You heard Captain Pembridge,"
shouted Slank, struggling to keep his tone serious.
"Let's get them scuppers keelhauled."
The men were smiling openly now, making no effort to hide their contempt for the little round man. They had good reasons. Cyrus Pembridge was easily the worst captain in British nautical history. He had never bothered to learn even the basics of seamanship, choosing instead to occupy his time consuming vast quantities of rum. He held command of the Neverlands solely because his wife's family owned a shipping line, and his wife detested him. She had insisted that he be given a ship, her thinking being that he would be away from home most of the time. Ideally, he would manage to sink his ship, and thus be out of her life altogether. The shipping company, following sound business practices, had given Pembridge its most worthless ship, staffed with the most incompetent and disposable crew. The crew had quickly realized that it was suicide to try to follow Pembridge's commands, which never made sense anyway. It was Slank who ran the Neverland. But on those rare occasions when Pembridge staggered out on deck, Slank and the crew amused themselves by pretending to obey him.
"Cast off the aft binnacle!"
Pembridge was shouting.
"Cast off that binnacle!"
repeated Slank to the grinning crew. Pembridge turned and looked at Slank as if seeing him for the first time.
"Who are you?" he said. "And why are you shouting?"
"I'm your first officer, sir," said Slank. "Mr. Slank, I'm just relaying your orders to the crew."
"Oh," said Pembridge.
"The aft binnacle has been cast off, sir," said Slank.
"The what?"
said Pembridge.
"The aft binnacle," said Slank, "as you ordered."
"I did,"
said Pembridge, squinting suspiciously.
"When?"
"Just now, sir," said Slank.
Pembridge blinked at Slank.
"Who are you again?"
he said.
"Your first officer, sir," said Slank.
Pembridge blinked again.
"My head hurts,"
he said.
"Perhaps the captain would like to go to his cabin," said Slank.
"You don't tell me what to do,"
said Pembridge.
"I'm the captain."
"Yes, sir," said Slank.
"I'm going to my cabin,"
said Pembridge.
"Yes, sir."
The round man took a step, then stopped, frowning, his round body teetering.
"Which way is my cabin?"
he said.
"That way, Captain Pembridge," said Slank, pointing aft.
Pembridge teetered off. Behind him, the crewman burst into laughter, only to be silenced by a scowl from Slank.
"That's enough," he shouted. "Back to work."
From behind a mast, Peter watched Pembridge stagger forward. Now seemed as good a time as any to try to talk to him. Peter stepped out from behind the mast and...
"You! Runt!"
bellowed Slank. The man saw everything.
"Where do you think you're going?"
"Nowhere, sir," said Peter.
"That's right," said Slank, striding toward Peter. "You're going nowhere. You're to stay below, and you're to come out when I say you can. We got work to do on this ship, and we don't need you in the way. You follow me, Runt?"
"Yes, sir."
"Can you swim, Runt?"
"I don't know, sir."
"Well, you'll find out quick enough if I see you on deck again without my permission."
"Yes, sir," said Peter.
Feeling Slank's glare on his back, he turned and went back down the ladderway, back to the cramped and smelly little cabin. As he entered, the other boys all looked at him hopefully.
"What did the captain say?"
said Tubby Ted.
"Can we have some real food?"
"Yes, Peter," said James. "What did the captain say?"
Well, said Peter, "I didn't talk to him just yet." The boys' faces fell. James looked down and sniffed.
"But I will," said Peter. "I'll talk to him. Just not right now. But don't you worry," he said, putting his hand on James's shoulder. "We'll be fine. I have a plan."
"You do?"
said James, looking up.
"Really?"
"Of course I do," said Peter, patting the shoulder.
"Oh, good," said James, "because I'm hungry." "I'm starving," said Tubby Ted.
"We'll have real food soon enough," said Peter. "I promise." And as he saw the hope return to the eyes of the other boys, Peter thought, "I need a plan." Chapter 6. Black Stash in Pursuit.
"She's getting away,"
Black Stash bellowed.
"Hurry up with Preston and Harbuckle and ready those barrels." "Hi, Captain,"
came a shout from below. Through his glass, Black Stash saw the Wasp's gleaming black hull race for the horizon, cutting a foaming white wake in the deep blue-green of the ocean. Black Stash had never seen a ship sail like that. He knew now that he no longer wanted only the Wasp's treasure. He wanted the Wasp herself. He'd strip her flag and fly his own on her mast.
"What flag should we be flying, Captain?"
First Mate Smee leaned his bulging belly over the open chest of flags captured from ships the Sea Devil had scuttled.
"Let's make it something colourful," said Black Stash. A Union Jack would do just fine, eh? She'd like that, wouldn't she, eh? Kissing cousins.
Blackstache liked the British flag. He had a dozen or more in his collection, and felt especially proud when he sank a ship belonging to the Queen. Blackstache had no love for the Queen, no love for women of any sort, except for his ma. He had a real soft spot for his ma, and was truly sorry for the time he'd marooned her.
"What's the delay down there?"
Blackstache thundered. On the main deck, several men were tying a fat crewman's ankles to his wrists behind his back, so he looked like a rocking horse. A gag covered the man's mouth, or he would have been heard screaming for his life. The Union Jack was run up the Sea Devil's mainmast and snapped loudly in the wind. Blackstache held the glass to his eye again, watching the retreating Wasp getting farther away each minute.
"How do you plan to take her?"
said Smee, grinning.
"Fire?"
One of Blackstache's many tricks was to sail close to another ship at night and, using a smoking barrel of tar, make it appear the Sea Devil had caught fire. His prey would turn and come to help, only to be rewarded for this act of mercy by being attacked. But Blackstache knew that even if he could get the Sea Devil close, the Wasp's captain, Scott, was too experienced to fall for that ploy.
"We'll have to think of something better than that,"
Blackstache said.
"The broken mast trick!"
Smee slapped his leg.
"I love that broken mast trick, Captain."
Blackstache snorted.
"She's carrying the richest treasure ever taken to sea," he said. "She won't fall for the broken mast."
Below, the crew had finished hog-tying the first man and had started on a second, also a portly fellow. He looked just as terrified, his cries muffled by a gag. At the man's muffled protests, Blackstache smiled. He loved other people's misery.
"Captain,"
said Smee very timidly.
"Why are they tying up Preston and Harbuckle?"
Preston and Harbuckle were both very good sailors, and Blackstache seemed preparing to toss them overboard for no good reason. Blackstache spat a gob onto Smee's bare foot.
"Smee," he said, "I've decided we're going to take the Wasp the old-fashioned way."
"Sir?"
"I mean, without cheating," said Blackstache.
"Without cheating, sir?"
Smee said, shocked. Blackstache always cheated.
"Not this time," said Blackstache. "Captain Scott won't stop the Wasp for no trickery. We got a pure runner down, Smee."
"But how, Captain?"
said Smee.
"Are we going to use the ladies?"
Blackstache shot Smee a look of contempt, which sent a chill down Smee's spine.
"You idiot,"
the captain sneered.
"We can't use the ladies on this heading. We've got to get a beam of the Wasp, then turn downwind. Then we raise the ladies and run her down."
"But, Captain,"
Smee said timidly,
"how do we get a beam of her? She's fast as the wind and pulling away."
"Yes," said Blackstache, "we need more speed, and that means we need to get rid of some weight. So I've ordered the crew to throw most of our water overboard."
He pointed toward the stern. Smee turned and saw crewmen rolling heavy wooden barrels toward the rail and heaving them over the side. Smee gasped. Even for Blackstache, this was insane. At sea, there was nothing more precious than water. Nothing. Not even rum. Nobody ever threw water away.
"Captain,"
Smee sputtered.
"Sir, we can't. I mean..."
"Smee," said Blackstache, savoring his own malignant brilliance. "Water is heavy, right?"
"Yes, Captain, but..."
"And we'll run faster without the weight, right?"
"Yes, Captain, but..."
"And if we run faster, we'll have a better chance of catching the Wasp, right?"
"I suppose so, Captain, but..."
"And when we catch the Wasp, we'll have the Wasp's water, won't we now?"
Smee fell silent now, finally grasping the lunatic plan.
"Don't you see?" said Blackstache. "It's a carrot for the men. They know we're carrying just enough water for a few days, so they know we have to catch the Wasp in that time, or they die of thirst. Isn't it a fine plan, Mr. Smee?"
"Insane,"
thought Smee, but what he said was,
"Aye, Captain, brilliant."
"Of course it's brilliant," said Blackstache. "And to make it even more brilliant, I'm going to give the crew another carrot."
"Another one, Captain?"
Smee did not like the sound of that at all.
"Yes,"
said Blackstache, admiring his own genius.
Smee, aside from water, cannon and cargo, what are the two heaviest things on the sea, devil?
Smee thought for a moment, then said,
That would be Preston and Hub.
He looked down at the deck, where the two fat pirates had been hefted into the dory, which was now being lowered alongside the ship.
You see, Smee, said Blackstache, this'll teach the men that